When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
Welcome to another edition of Sly's Office. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. John, I want to lead off with what happened in Oklahoma last night. Now, Oklahoma is a state that Donald Trump won by 36 points.
Sly, can I stop you there?
Yes.
Would you repeat that number?
36 points.
Whoa. All right.
Every county he won in the Sooner State. Okay? Okay. So here's the news from KOCO, the CBS affiliate or ABC affiliate in Oklahoma City.
Today, the White House refused to say whether...
Much, a lot of election results to break down here, so let's get to it. In our Commitment 2020 coverage now, Medicaid expansion passes in Oklahoma. It was a narrow vote here, passing by only one percentage point. State question 802, as we've been talking about here for the last few weeks, expand Medicaid health insurance to tens of thousands of low-income residents. It is expected to cost the state $164 million a year, but it would bring an estimated $1.2 billion yearly from the federal government.
And in a big upset last night, ACLU organizer Marie Turner beat out incumbent Jason Dunnington for the Democratic nomination for District 88. And we caught up with her after those results came in.
I never really thought we would be at a place to see a black, queer, Muslim woman elected in Oklahoma.
That's news from Oklahoma. I'm not laughing about the woman winning the primary, but it just shows you how the world is changing.
Well, no, she's expressing the something that I'm hearing all over America. I'm looking at these results from rural counties and you know, places you would not expect where there are breakthrough wins going on. So it's pretty significant, but I think the astounding thing out of what happened in Oklahoma was this vote on Medicaid expansion, which is, you know, Oklahoma's not the first. We've had it in a number of Western states. And you know, here's where it gets really interesting, because you heard in that report they said, well, it's going to cost the state $100 million, but they're going
to get a couple billion.
$1.2 billion or something like that. And you're sort of like, in the scheme of things, if I said to you, Sly, you know, I'm going to get you the biggest house in town. You know, you're going to get the best house ever. And it's going to cost you $100,000. I'll chip in the other $1.2 billion, right? Would you say that was a bad deal?
Well, the only way it's a bad deal is if you absolutely don't care about covering people.
Well, that's the point. I mean, that's the point I'm getting to here, is that the Republicans who blocked Medicaid expansion, and that includes folks here in Wisconsin.
Scott Walker.
But the Republicans who blocked Medicaid expansion, they had an argument which they only got away with because of media malfeasance, right? Because the media would say, you know, well, the governor says he doesn't want it because it would cost Wisconsin taxpayers money. And too often they let them get away with that. They let them just say that. And even the Democrats sometimes, you know, it's like, well, it's not that much. We can find it. Blah, blah, blah. No, what they should say is this man can't do math. You know, either he can't do math, right? You know, that which is potentially a reality, or he is so ideologically rigid that he would allow people to go without health care, working people to go without health care because he doesn't want to risk the success of a health care expansion, right? And that's, I think that gets to the heart of the matter, If you meet a Republican who says, "Oh, I'm opposed to Medicaid expansion because it would be expensive or it would, you know, cost money," so you say, "No. Either you don't know how to do math, or the more likely reality is you're terrified. You're terrified that showing people that you can do a healthcare system that is humane and decent and use healthcare as a right might begin with Medicaid expansion and in very short order lead to Medicare for all, single payer healthcare for everyone."
Here's another observation about this election. Okay, so the early mail-in vote overwhelmingly supported this. The day of vote, especially from the rural areas of Oklahoma, overwhelmingly against. I suspect the Trump administration is going to see that, and that is going to further their intransigence about mail-in voting.
No, look, they are intransigent about mail-in voting. They are, you know, absolutely...
Even though they all mail-in vote.
No, they're rigid on it, right? And then they try to make, you know, exception. Oh, well, it's, you know, I'm doing something important. Well, you know what? Working class people are doing important stuff, too. They just don't get the, you know, they don't get the excuses that you get. But here's the interesting thing. At the same time that they're rigorously against mail-in voting, right, and saying how bad it is and that, they're also saying they want to narrow early voting, right? They're putting limits on early voting, which means that it's harder to cast an in-person absentee vote early, which is something that's done a lot around the country. So understand what they're doing in this coronavirus moment, this COVID-19 moment. They are, when we're actually seeing a huge resurgence, and we could very easily see a huge resurgence again in the fall, right around the November election, they're saying, we don't want you to be able to vote by mail. We want you to have to go in person. And we're not going to make it easy for you to vote early. We're going to, you know, kind of drive you toward that election day. They're actually creating a circumstance that errs on the side of long lines and crowded polling places in a potential pandemic.
There was a poll worker they interviewed in Oklahoma yesterday who, you know, elderly man, but felt it was his civic duty to work the polls. He had his little visor on and everything, and he said, look, because I'm doing this, I'm going to have to give up physical therapy for a month because I'm going to have to put myself back in quarantine. But I felt it was so important that I carry out this civic duty that I'm going to do it. That is so patriotic and gratifying to...
It's patriotic and it's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking.
At the same time.
Because it's avoidable.
Yeah. And, you know, my daughter worked at the polling places for, I think it was 10 hours on April 7th, you know, in our pandemic election in Wisconsin. And I have to tell you, that was at a peak of the pandemic. And I was, you know, like any concerned father, I was really worried for her. And they did a good job in Madison, and she was very determined. And it was really an expression of again, a deep sense of commitment to democracy and a belief that it was something that you needed to do. I was very proud of her. I was very proud of everybody that went out and did the job on Election Day. But at the same time, while I'm very proud of that, and you can feel that sense of respect and regard, and while I'm very proud of the people who got in those lines in Milwaukee and, you know, who waited hours sometimes, and you can feel a sense of respect and regard for them, the fact is, this is absurd. People shouldn't, it shouldn't have to be an act of immense courage to cast a ballot in Wisconsin or in Oklahoma or anywhere in the United States. It should be something that is easy, functional, safe, and fair. And we actually know exactly how to do easy, functional, safe, and fair elections. You have a lot of vote by mail. You have in-person absentee voting or early voting, you know, starting a month out or long period with being able to do it on weekends and nights when working folks might have an easier time of it. And then you do have safe voting on election day. You make sure that it's all retrofitted and everything.
All right. Well, let me ask you about another facet of this, because we have a couple results from the last few days. First, in Kentucky, where Amy McGrath defeated Charles Booker for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate in Kentucky. McGrath won the early vote. Booker won the same day voting. There was a clear difference there because the momentum in the race had changed. John Hickenlooper obviously won the early mail-in vote. I don't know if, you know, that race, there was a 20-point difference with Romanoff.
Yeah.
But how in the future do we function where, you know, we have the rhythm of the campaign and things develop, and things that develop in the last week of a campaign can be crucial. People can make gaffes. You don't get to pull your ballot back. You don't get to change your vote. Is this the downside of mail-in voting and early voting?
It's a challenge, and I've looked at this a lot and written about it a lot around the country. In Oregon and Washington, where they've done it for a long time, the rhythm has changed. And so newspapers, for instance, do their endorsements, for the most part, very early, you know, right at the start of the early voting process, you know, right at the start of the mail-in process, rather than waiting until the weekend before and, you know, building up all the excitement about it. And candidates focus mailings and their energy based on that rhythm, based on that cycle. And so I do think that you can kind of relearn the rhythm, right? I think it's possible, but you get to something that is a huge issue, and that is that, you know, in places that don't have the new rhythm, right, where they're still operating on the old model, a candidate like Charles Booker, who I wrote about, I started writing about in January, I've been impressed with him from the beginning of his run, you know, he hit his mark in June, not long before the election. He started to get endorsements, lots of endorsements, but they came so late in the game that many people who undoubtedly would have voted for him had already cast their ballot for his opponent. And this is a challenging reality. It goes back to, you know this from when you were a kid, and it's pretty much an accepted reality that if Hubert Humphrey had two more days in 1968, he was surging in the polls. There's simply no question of that. He would have beaten Richard Nixon. I mean, he had been written off as a candidate. It was expected that he wasn't going to win. It had the Chicago Convention, lots of crises. And then things really took off for him at the end. And there's very little question. If he'd had a couple more days, it would have worked. This is one of the intangibles of politics, is timing often decides fate. Timing is fate. And so we have to think about that as we restructure election approaches and election rules, that we don't disempower the exciting, surging grassroots candidate who builds to this great crescendo.
All right, what have we learned from Kentucky and Colorado in their Senate primaries?
I think we learned a lot. What you had was a situation where, in both those states, where folks in D.C. decided last year who the Democratic nominee was going to be. And they said, okay, we have a cookie-cutter candidate, right? That doesn't mean they're always the same. What I mean is somebody who fits into that design.
You have peanut butter cookies, you have spritz cookies, different types of cookies.
Yeah, you still got a basic imprint there, right? A certain kind of candidate who's going to be very cautious in their messaging, who is going to highlight their personal story. And, of course, this is what makes – there is the distinction. They sometimes have very good personal stories rather than issues, right? There's going to be much more emphasis on, you know, I'm a nice person, or I'm an interesting person, or I'm an entrepreneur, or I was in the military, or I was this or that.
Well, you know, can't you have both? I mean, Bob Kerry was the epitome of what a biography, and he was really sharp-spoken and deep, yeah.
Of course you can. But that's not always, in fact, that's almost never what the Democrats in Washington are looking for. They so frequently want a candidate who runs, you know, a very narrow race, who takes a set of talking points, and frankly, they clearly tell these people, yeah, it's okay to run away from the Democratic Party. It's okay to, you know, like, you know, go often as centrist or even conservative as you want if you think that's going to work. Well, two things. One, it never works. You know, it's not a good strategy because we now live in a mobilization moment. And so it doesn't matter how, you know, centrist or conservative a Democrat is, they're still going to be called socialists by the Republicans. And so it really is about building out your base. And in both Colorado and Kentucky, as you got toward the close of those primary elections, you saw outsider candidates who had not been approved by the folks in Washington rising up and, you know, really closing gaps. Now, Charles Booker, who I fully believe will eventually be the mayor of Louisville, or Rand Paul's opponent, or something. You know what I mean? I think he has a tremendous future ahead of him. He closed to within a tiny
couple points, yeah,
number of votes. I mean, he was there, but for, and frankly, another thing on structure there, if they had had voting at the traditional precinct level, I think the in election day voting would have been higher, and he might well have closed that gap. They instead went to one polling location per county, and people had to drive to it. There were traffic jams.
Brilliant idea, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. It would be like everybody in Dane County voting at the Coliseum,
right?
Even if you live in Stoughton. And so I think a lot of things got in his way, but he still had this incredible finish. Andrew Romanoff running in Colorado, really focusing on environmental issues, but also embracing Black Lives Matter and the moment that we're in, went from being nowhere in the polls to very much closing the gap. He clearly didn't win. He got beat. But, you know, I do think that voters are very interested in authentic candidates, and I think it's risky. It's very risky when you try to, you know, decide in D.C. who would be the best candidate for a state. I wish the Democrats in D.C. would back off a little on that. And the final thing I'll say is this. One of the things that was revealed as that campaign went on in both Kentucky and in Colorado was real vulnerabilities, real weaknesses with the D.C. picked candidate, challenges, things they said, things they did that will undoubtedly haunt them as they go into the November race. Now, with that said, I think there's still a really good chance they'll win, right? But it's one of the things that you want in a primary is for candidates to show their strengths, their weaknesses as well. And when the folks in D.C. put too big a thumb on the scale, they make that less likely.
John Nichols from the Capital Times. We'll talk more here at Sly's office coming up next.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep Sly'sOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from Sly'sOffice.com.
We're back at Sly's Office, brought to you by our friends at the Operating Engineers, Local 139. Also, Madison Teachers Incorporated, Madison Firefighters Local 311, and Madison Teamsters Local 695. All right. So, America is the laughingstock in the world, along with Brazil and Russia, in dealing with this COVID virus. This is from ABC.
Nearly a quarter of a million cases, and the governor with a stern warning.
If you're not going to stay home and you're not going to wear masks in public, we have to enforce, and we will.
The situation so dire that New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, which have beaten back COVID after tens of thousands of deaths, now slapping a 14-day quarantine on visitors from California and a growing list of 15 other states where the virus is surging. With the nation notching 40,000 new cases a day, Dr. Anthony Fauci today warning those case numbers could easily double.
I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around, and so I am very concerned. I think it's important to tell you and the American public that I'm very concerned because it could get very bad.
It is bad in California's farm belt of Imperial County. So overwhelmed, they've medevaced over 500 patients out of the county. And outside that hospital, a tent to handle the surge of patients. Morgues have backed up, and now the county is ordering refrigerated trunks for the dead. And nearby Riverside County, 99% of the ICUs full.
We're seeing a large number of cases coming in where multiple family members are infected.
Los Angeles County, with over 100,000 cases alone, closing beaches and banning fireworks over the 4th of July weekend. 51-year-old Tommy Moskis of California sharing on Facebook that he was diagnosed with COVID after going to a barbecue. Because of my stupidity, I put my mom and sisters and my family's health in jeopardy. This has been a very painful experience. His family says he was a diabetic and had been careful wearing masks and social distancing for months. But Tommy Macias passed away the day he went to the hospital.
That is just such a horrendous story. You know,
heartbreaking.
I think we all want to think about just a bunch of rednecks that are Trump voters that have gotten the wrong message out of what's going on. But, John, it isn't just conservatives that are being reckless. Yesterday, there was a reporter on the beach in Miami and talking to young people, and they were like, yeah, there's something going on with that, but, you know, I read conflicting stuff on the internet, so I'm not really worried about it. Why are Americans so dumb?
I don't know that we're dumb. Okay.
What the hell is wrong?
Let me rephrase. But look,
like that man took all the precautions. There some signal was sent to him that suddenly it was okay, and it cost him his life.
And this is happening all over. You know, I mean, I think the fact that kind of jarred me. So many things have jarred me of late. And fact is that have you seen this comparison with Texas and Italy? Do you know that Texas now has, and I read the Newsweek headline here, Texas's daily COVID-19 cases now tops Italy's record when it was the global epicenter. So you remember a couple months ago, we were all kind of watching CNN and, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, watching the reports from Italy, northern Italy especially, and thinking, what a tragedy, what a disaster. Well, Texas is now competing with that, right? And yet, our media is not covering it that way, right? We are not looking at it with the same eyes that we looked at things in March and early April. And I have said this with you before when we talked about other issues. I genuinely think this is a media problem. Now, it's easy to blame Trump, and Trump takes a share of blame because he gives the wrong information, he pressures for openings, he and his allies, an immense amount of guilt. They are guilty men. There is no doubt of that. But there's also a media in this country which I think does a lousy job of keeping perspective, right? And I genuinely think there's folks in the media who are just catching on now. But as this was rising over the last few weeks, we're sort of operating on the mode of, oh, we covered that story before. You know, we already did that story.
Well, we had civil rights marches that sort of, pulled the attention away because they can only do one topic at a time. Here is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. This story out of Florida is amazing.
His governor said his state was a success story just last month.
You got a lot of people in your profession who waxed poetically for weeks and weeks about how Florida was going to be just like New York. Wait 2 weeks, Florida's going to be next. Just like Italy, wait 2 weeks. Well, hell, we're 8 weeks away from that, and it hasn't happened.
You know, when I look at that greasy-haired fool, I look into his eyes, and I see nothing. I see nothing but a shameful pandering idiot leading one of the biggest states in the country. Now, you listen to the arrogance in his voice from a month ago, and we all knew this was going to happen.
Yep. And, you know, the interesting thing is that his TV ads were him, like, I think he was, like, reading to his kids about Donald Trump, right? I mean, his argument for being governor was a pretty weak one at the start. He beat a really incredible candidate who was doing a great campaign. It was a very close result. End result, though, look, the fact of the matter is that you have people like DeSantis in Florida and a number of other Republican governors.
Oh, Brian Kemp.
Yeah, yeah, who sent terrible messages, who were absolutely wrongheaded. And yes, and that does feed into a media narrative, right? Because the media says, oh, these are, you know, it's a governor, we've got to cover them, got to, you know, and then somebody disagrees, but it's always, you know, like the public health person saying, I'm not sure that's right. And I do think a lack of media perspective on this. And I don't let them off the hook by, you know, the argument, well, there's other news. Yeah, there is other news. You know, the President of the United States stands accused of, you know, not being concerned when it was revealed or when there's this suggestion that Russians were, you know, putting bounties on the heads of American soldiers. That's a pretty big story. That's a very legitimate story. We have finally, after dramatically too long, a reckoning with issues of policing and racial injustice in this country, people rising up and demanding answers. That's a vital story that has to be covered. There's no question of that. And you know what? I'm not trying to be nostalgic here, but it used to be possible to cover a couple of vital stories, stories, and then also to cover a public health crisis.
Well, you know, and I do it all. And I also watch these young reporters from the local TV stations, and not to pick on them, but whatever, you know, whatever story they're coming at you with, they're stenographers. And frankly, I see them cover stories where I agree with the person they're interviewing, but they don't challenge them. They never challenge anyone. We don't have anybody with any gravitas to bring you a compelling story with some balance. It's really awful. It's terrible reporting. Awful.
Well, and it's something that we see, and it's not. It isn't just in one town. It's all over the country. And this is the point I get to, is that you know, when we talk about systemic challenges, you know, why things happen, why they keep happening, you have to look at all the inputs, right? All the places where folks get their information. And so that's why when you asked initially, are the American people stupid, right? And why my reaction is, look, before we start to get mad at the American people, and look, I do think people should be wearing masks. I do think people should be, you know, recognizing the danger they're in. But before you get too mad at the American people, you do have to look at their leaders, at their media, and you have to ask yourself, you know, are they, you know, at what point do people have to, you know, stop believing their leaders, stop believing their media, kind of be out there on their own and figure things out? It shouldn't be that way.
You know, it's a far cry from America pulling together and all pitching in to win World War II. That is for sure. Let me ask you this finally. State of Wisconsin, headline, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Don't expect a face mask requirement or statewide bar closures in Wisconsin. And then there's all sorts of finger pointing. The governor's disappeared. I don't even know where the governor is. Last time I saw him, he was surveying the damage at the state capitol after the criminals decided to destroy our state property. That's the last time I saw him. Jeffrey Mandel, who's a pretty good attorney, says that Evers, in fact, could issue an emergency declaration to put in place new rules to fight the coronavirus pandemic. Under the emergency order, he could try to impose a mask requirement. And yet, Evers is sort of just shrugging your shoulder. The Republicans are saying, no, you can't do that, and we're not even going to let local communities do that. Excuse me, he's not Tony the Tiger right now. He's Tony the Mouse. Well, has he given up?
The governor should be stepping up in a much more fundamental way on a host of issues, and he should be heard much more.
Where is he?
I look, it's very frustrating at this point because, you know, The governor of Wisconsin at this point does not have the power that many governors in the past have had because he has a legislature that will not work with him. It's easy to blame the legislature, and there's plenty of blame to be put there on, you know, let's be clear, on the failure of the legislature to take up issues addressing policing and other things that the governor said, hey, we need to do that.
Let me finish the circle here, Sly.
So the governor's put some ideas forward, and the legislature hasn't responded. That's not letting the governor off the hook, though. And the same with responding to COVID-19. The critical thing is that what Tony Evers needs to recognize is that he has a bully pulpit. And even though he is disempowered by Republican legislators, that's not an excuse. He can be on television, on radio, on, you know, in the paper on a daily basis. He can be very physically present and make his position known and frankly, you know, campaign for it. That's not a complicated lesson in our politics. And you understand who knew that? Ronald Reagan, of all people, knew that. If he didn't have a Congress that was on his side, what did he do? He went out and campaigned for an idea and kind of forced it forward. At their best, a leader uses their bully pulpit to change the debate sufficiently on a host of issues so that, you know, they're in the game, even if they don't necessarily have the easy alliances.
In Pierre, and it's Canada Day as we record this, so happy Canada Day. In Pierre Elliott Trudeau's final address at a Liberal convention when he was stepping down in 1984 in Ottawa, he got up and said, thank you for being with me when we were behind on an issue and we were being blocked by the premiers and we were being blocked by the corporations and we were being blocked by the media. We went over their heads and we used the bully pulpit to get. And you know what? The crowd went crazy. It was the last thing he said. Okay. That is the whole point of governing. And you know, the governor's got an incompetent staff. Maggie Gow should have been tossed out of there a long time ago. This recording stuff is just an absolute embarrassment. She should have been tossed out of there a long time ago. I am very, very, very concerned about the future of his administration.
Look, the governor of Wisconsin ought to be present on a daily basis, especially in this critical moment. And to circle it around to the core thing you were talking about there, we have a public health crisis. It is rising in concern and significance. And this is a time for someone to step up, right? If, you know, if the governor does not step up, he runs the risk that people who are not sending the right messages will fill that void.
Correct. Here's the thing. When he was on TV once a day doing those press conferences, his poll numbers were sky high.
Through the roof.
You look at the last Marquette poll, he has slipped. Now, he still has much better numbers than Donald Trump does, but he has slipped 5-6 points. It's because he's disappeared.
I cannot disagree with, or I'm not going to disagree with you. I think that this is actually a point where, because the issues are so monumental, and again, a host of issues, you know, talking about policing, talking about the economic crisis, mass unemployment, talking about a rising public health crisis, a returning public health crisis. These are issues that people want to have leadership on.
Well,
and if he calls out the Republicans for not leading on it, for not working with him, at the very least, he's making it clear where the problem is.
Well, let me just wrap it up with this. You know, there are people that still haven't received their unemployment. Completely inexcusable. It's happening all over the country, but that's no excuse. Mm-hmm. Had I been the governor, I would have taken all the resources of the state. There are a lot of state workers that are getting paid right now that aren't able to do a whole lot. I would have used every resource under my ability. I would have done everything in my power to make that number one priority, to make sure that people got their unemployment checks. And here we are heading for a second wave, and it appears as though they don't have the problem fixed. It's very disconcerting. The Republicans are awful. They have proven that they care more about money than lives, and it's actually stupid because in the long run, they're going to cost us a lot more money in the economy. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation, thanks for coming to Sly's office.
Thank you, brother.
Sly'sOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.